Chapter 6. Other Significant Races. Vampires. The Children of the Night are an increasing presence in Ankh-Morpork these days, thanks to the efforts of the Uberwald League of Temperance. Sensible vampires have realized that a diet of black pudding and blood sausage and a stake in a growing economy is much to be preferred to just a stake. However, it was not always thus. The vampire, or at least the image of the vampire, has evolved quite markedly over the centuries. Do vampires suck blood? Silly question nowadays. If there's one thing everybody knows about vampires, it's that they suck your blood, leaving you with two neat puncture marks at the base of your neck. Of course, what everyone knows is wrong, and nearly everyone knows it. At least, we think so. The trouble with what everyone knows is that you can never be sure that everyone knows it. But surely everyone knows that vampires, like werewolves, have stepped out of folklore and into popular culture. The movies, of course, were the major influence. In the 1950s and 60s, a generation grew up, thanks to Hammer films, knowing that female vampires always wore underwired nightgowns. And male ones, a high-collared black cloak with a red satin lining. And also that in the inevitable chase scene, the coach would always break down in the same place in Black Park near Pinewood Studios, according to Terry. This may not be strictly true, but it gave him the idea for Don't Go Near the Castle. But it was not always so. In the folklore of the Balkans, Greece, and Central Europe, a vampire, also known as Nosferatu, a Vrykolakos, or a Nachtzera, was simply an undead revenant, a corpse that gets out of its grave and wanders about. Some sucked blood, others didn't. Instead, they might breathe on you and give you plague, cholera, or consumption, or sit on your chest and give you nightmares, or strangle you, or beat you black and blue, or simply get into your house and smash the furniture. Subtle and elegant, they were not. Their close relative, the Drog of medieval Iceland, would break every bone of your body, and of your cattle, too. Early European vampires were not aristocrats, but village folk. They did not look like noble gentlemen in black cloaks, or luscious women in low-cut ball gowns. They looked like what they were, corpses. To be precise, corpses that had been buried long enough to begin decaying, but not long enough to turn into nice clean skeletons. When terrified locals dug into the grave of a suspected vampire to destroy him, they would find a body bloated with gases, and therefore plumper and bigger than when alive. The skin taut, the blood no longer congealed, but runny, and often oozing from the mouth or nose. The face puffy and red, or in some cases, dusky. If they jabbed a stake or spade into it, nasty reddish liquids gushed out. They might even hear a sort of grunt or squawk as the blow forced the gases out through the windpipe. Who could doubt that this was an undead? Such a corpse must then be destroyed by burning. If this is too difficult, dead bodies take a lot of burning, at least it can be mutilated or pinned down in some way, so that it will never walk again, which is where staking comes in, or beheading, or tearing the heart out. Vampires as the earth knows them now are rather different. They were created by English writers in the Romantic and Victorian periods, and perfected by that most powerful myth-making medium, the cinema. The first was Lord Ruthven in John Polidori's story The Vampire, 1819, an evil, blood-sucking, deathless aristocrat. Then in 1872 came Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu's story about the beautiful young Carmilla, who, like Salacia in Thud, assumes she could evade discovery by making anagrams of her name, Milaka, Mirkala. She was gentler than Lord Ruthven, but she too brought death. She was eventually found in a blood-filled coffin, staked and decapitated. And then, in 1897, Bram Stoker's Dracula appeared, presenting the sinister but elegantly seductive Count, his female victims, and three erotic female vampires. Stoker stole the Count's name from the real-life Vlad Dracul, also known as Vlad Tepes the Impaler, one of the great warrior princes of Romanian history, who in his native country is respectfully remembered as a hero and is never, never thought of as a vampire. Stoker also adopted many details from East European folklore. For over 100 years now, the Dracula figure and its variants have been fixed in modern popular mythology. Fangs, swirling black cloaks with red linings, brocaded waistcoats, a haughty manner, and an escort of bats, rats, and wolves. On Discworld, the Count de Magpire is a magnificent example of the aristocratic vampire, sprung from an ancient family whose motto is Carpe Jugulum, go for the jugular. His son, Vlad, is very much the dandy. His daughter, Lacrimosa, is a thin girl in a white dress with very long black hair and far too much eye makeup. Their home is a castle on a crag in Überwald, complete with sinister ancestral portraits. One of these shows Aunt Carmilla, a far more savage figure than Le Fanu's heroine of the same name. She used to bathe in the blood of up to 200 virgins at a time, just as the real-life Hungarian countess, Elizabeth Báthory, was rumoured to do. It was a good cosmetic. There is also the portrait of the old Count de Magpire, father of the present one, and remembered by some as Old Red Eyes. A bald head, dark-rimmed, staring eyes, two teeth like needles, two ears like bat wings, fingernails that hadn't been trimmed for years. That's something known on this world, too. That's Nosferatu, perhaps the most terrifying vampire in the history of the cinema, as created in 1922. But the current Count de Magpire is adapting to modern times, to the fury of his servant Igor, whose attitude can be described as more gothic than thou. He and his family wear full evening dress in the evenings only, not all the time, as his father the old Count did. The rest of the time, it's fancy waistcoats for the men and lacy skirts for the women. In the castle, squeaky door hinges must now be oiled, guttering candles removed, spiders chased out of the dungeons. There must be no black plumes on the coach or its horses. Coaches, looking like hearses, are not at all cool. The Count's aim is to train his family little by little to overcome all the taboos which limit a vampire's freedom, and which are only cultural conditioning, a conditioning which, strangely, seems to be much the same on the Discworld and the Earth. He believes that with a little effort and practice, modern vampires could and should learn to drink wine, go out in sunlight, cross running water, eat garlic-flavoured canapes, bear the touch of holy water, and look at any sacred symbol without wincing. By and large, the plan seems to be succeeding, but they still can't enter a house unless invited. As was noted earlier, quite a number of Discworld vampires hope to become integrated into society as a whole, and so have joined the Überwald League of Temperance. Members have forsworn the drinking of human blood, or, as they prefer to call it, the B-word. They carry their badge, a small twist of shiny black ribbon, and gather regularly in mutual support groups for a nice sing-song with cocoa and a bun. One black ribboner is Otto Krieg, a brilliant iconographer on the staff of the Ankh-Morpork Times. He dresses as the cinematic stereotype requires, and speaks, when he wants to, with a thick Überwald accent, deliberately so, to make people laugh. That way, no one fears him or hates him, since Otto, personally, has not overcome his hereditary allergy to strong light. He suffers intensely whenever he has to use a flash, sometimes even crumbling to dust. He carries a card for such emergencies.
Do not be alarmed. The former bearer of this card has suffered a minor accident. You will need a drop of blood from any species, and a dustpan and brush.
from the truth. If some kind person dribbles a drop or two from, say, a piece of raw steak onto the dust, it mushrooms up into the air, becomes a mass of coloured flecks, and once again is Otto Creek. From the information so far available, it looks as if all Discworld vampires become such, either by their genetics or by being bitten. Admittedly, one may suspect that the genes of the late Count Not Far Auto were pretty reluctant to be activated in the unlikely DNA of his only remaining relative, his nephew Arthur Winkings, who was a coming man in the wholesale fruit and vegetable business. And Arthur was even more reluctant to receive them, as we learn in Reaper Man. But that's how it goes. If you inherit the title and the estates, you get the coffin and the bat wings too. Genetics or a bite. Take your choice. On the Earth, this is true in the literary and cinematic mythology, but in European folklore, there are plenty of other reasons why the dead become vampires. They may have lived an evil life, committed suicide, or practiced black magic. They may have been conceived in sacrilege, their parents having had sex on a holy day. They may have been born with teeth, or a tail, or two hearts. Or a call. As we will see later, two hearts are magical. However, the only known person with two hearts on the planet Earth is Doctor Who. In Romania, anyone with red hair and blue eyes is regarded as a potential vampire. In many parts of Europe, a corpse will become a revenant if it is left unburied, or buried secretly without proper rites. If it is laid out at home, it should be in a lighted room, and there should always be somebody keeping watch. No dog or cat should be allowed to jump onto or over it. Break any of these rules, and you will soon have a vampire in the village. And when you do, what do you do about it? As the quite Reverend Oates, self-appointed Omnian missionary to Lancrey, explains to Nanny Og, "It depends exactly where they're from, I remember. Uberwald is a very big place. Cutting off the head and sticking them in the heart is generally efficacious. In splints, they die if you put a coin in their mouth and cut their head off. In clots, they die if you stick a lemon in their mouth after you cut their head off. I believe that in glits, you have to fill their mouth with salt, hammer a carrot into both ears, and then cut off their head. And in the Valley of the Ahr, they believe it's best to cut off the head and boil it in vinegar. But in Kashankari, they say you should cut off their toes and drive a nail through their neck. And cut their head off? Apparently you don't have to." From Carpe Jugulum. Decapitation was the folk method in parts of Europe too, especially among Germans and Western Slavs, with the addition that the severed head must be placed between the legs of the corpse, behind its buttocks or below its feet, so that it couldn't find it and put it back on. The southern Slavs preferred staking the corpse. Greeks cremated it, often cutting the heart out first. Russians would throw it into a lake or river. Danes staked revenants. Medieval Icelanders beheaded and or burned them. There was no need to stick to one method at a time. In Germany, one woman who walked was dug up, decapitated, and then reburied at a crossroads with her mouth full of poppy seeds. Another corpse was taken to a border between two districts, cut open, staked through the heart, and beheaded. A stone was put in the mouth, and both body and head were left lying there for animals to eat. Of course, it was best if you could stop the corpse from leaving its grave at all by giving it something to do which would keep it there. For example, Oates told Nanny Og, "You can defeat vampires by stealing their sock." They're pathologically meticulous, you see. Some of the gypsy tribes in Borogravia say that if you steal their sock and hide it somewhere, they'll spend the rest of eternity looking for it. They can't abide things to be out of place or missing. They say in some villages that you can even slow them down by throwing poppy seed at them. Then they'll have a terrible urge to count every seed. Vampires are very anal retentive, you see. Paul Barber, a notable American authority on vampires, has similarly stressed their limited, rigid, and compulsive nature. This makes it easier to stop them from coming home after burial. For instance, they have to re-enter the house in the same way they left it. So if you lift the coffin out through a window or a hole in the wall instead of using the door, and then shut the window or refill the hole, they'll never find the way back. If you bury them face down, when they try to dig themselves out, they'll just go down deeper and deeper. If you put seeds or sand in a vampire's mouth or coffin or on the path to the graveyard, this activates his compulsions. He must collect the grains one at a time, and often only one grain per year. This so engages his attention that he is obliged to drop all other pursuits. Nets and knitted stockings in the coffin are just as good. He has to unpick them, one knot or stitch per year. As for putting coins, pebbles, dirt or food in the corpse's mouth, that gives him something satisfying to chew on. So a girl setting out to be a vampire slayer in Überwald needs a big sack to be ready for all possibilities. She must carry a stake and mallet, a spade and a strong knife. Nets, seeds, coins, sand, salt, stones, lemons, garlic, assorted vegetables, thorns and needles to stick in the vampire's feet to stop him walking, and in his tongue to stop him sucking, a flask of holy water, and the sacred symbols of all major gods. But, as Nanny Ogg could tell her, there is a better way. She could simply borrow Grebo the cat, and wait till a very large red-eyed bat comes by. For that would be a flabbergast, which is foreign for bat, Nanny Ogg explains. And a flabbergast is a shape-shifted vampire, and it would very soon learn the useful truth set down in Witches Abroad. Vampires have risen from the dead, the grave, and the crypt, but have never managed it from the cat. Banshees. These unpleasant and mercifully rare creatures, native to the Überwald Mountains, are the only humanoid species on the Discworld that has evolved wings, apart from certain small elves. Vampires who fly, such as the Count de Magpire and his family, simply do so by a form of levitation. However, there may possibly be some remote genetic connection between the two races, since a banshee has two hearts, which, according to some folk traditions, is a characteristic of vampires. No research has been done on this topic, nor is likely to be. A Discworld banshee is about the same size as a man, but far more lightly built, consisting almost entirely of thin bones and very strong sinews, several rows of pointy teeth, and huge claws. At first glance, you would think it is wearing a black leather cloak. This, as you will soon discover, is its wings. And then, there is its scream. It was harsh, guttural. It was malice and hunger given a voice. Small, huddling, shrew-like creatures had once heard sounds like that, circling over the swamps. From Going Postal. It is well known that to hear the banshee's scream means that you are going to die. With the more civilized banshees, all this means is that they have taken on the job of a death omen, and will sit screeching on your roof to make sure you get plenty of warning that death is on his way. Indeed, in Ankh-Morpork, there is one solitary and gloomy banshee, named Ixolite, who suffers from a speech impediment and just writes "oo-ee, oo-ee" on a scrap of paper, and slips it under your door. But the wild banshees, such as Mr. Grill, described in Going Postal, do the whole job themselves. One minute you hear the scream, next minute there's a swoop and a pounce, and some quite remarkable claws. Over in our own parallel universe, banshees are only to be found in one particular habitat, namely Ireland. The name, if not the species, must have originated there, since banshee makes good sense in Irish, though it is mere gibberish in Discworld languages. It means woman of the other world. For in Ireland, the creature is invariably female. Her mission is to announce the imminent death of someone in one of the old aristocratic Irish families by screaming and wailing near their homes. She is more often heard than seen, but when she does let herself be glimpsed, it is as an old woman with long, loose white hair which she combs as she wails. Sometimes she is seen crouching by a river, washing a winding sheet. In some parts of the country, she is also known as the Bohinta, meaning the keening scald crow, though she does not nowadays actually appear in crow shape. Though the Irish banshee is no predator, it is best to be wary of offending her. There was once a man who saw a banshee combing her hair on the riverbank at twilight, crept up behind her, and snatched her comb. He ran home with it. That night, there were terrifying shrieks all around his house, and something was hammering on his window, so he opened the window just a little way and pushed the comb out, holding it in the big iron tongs from the fireplace. And it was well for him that he did so, rather than putting his hand out, for the thing that grabbed the comb grabbed the tongs too, and threw them to the ground, all bent and twisted. Such is a banshee's strength. Golems. In all societies, there is a good deal of boring, dirty, heavy work which nobody really wants to do, whatever the pay. So what could be better than to find a race of strong, tireless, silent workers to take on these jobs, especially if they don't need paying? The historical solution in Ankh-Morpork is the golems. Large, powerful creatures made of baked clay, roughly humanoid in form, but 7 or 8 feet tall. They need no food or sleep. They can work underwater or in extremes of heat or cold or in total darkness. They cannot feel pain or boredom. They can repair themselves and last for centuries. Their triangular eyes have the faint dark red glow of a banked fire, and on the rare occasions when they open their mouths, you get a brief glimpse of an inferno. According to the original specifications, they cannot speak, though they can write. This, however, was changed at the insistence of Commander Vimes, after the events recounted in Feet of Clay. A golem's head is hollow and flips open when you press a line across the forehead. Inside is a yellowing scroll bearing words in Cenotine, an ancient sacred script, the language of a dead religion. This has to have been written by a priest. Take out the scroll, and the light in the golem's eyes goes out, and its life, if it can be called life, ceases. Put it back, and it comes alive again. When the golem Dorful is asked to explain itself, it writes on a slate, "I am a golem. I was made of clay. My life is the words. By means of words of purpose in my head, I acquire life. My life is to work. I obey all commands. I take no rest. Golem must work. Golem must have a master." From Feet of Clay. The written commands in a golem's head are those which the Cenotine god is said to have given to the first people on earth after he had baked them out of clay. "Thou shalt labour fruitfully all the days of your life," is one of them, and another is, "Thou shalt not kill," and a third, "Thou shalt be humble." Not surprisingly, factory owners are prepared to pay a good price for golems. There are stories that sometimes one of them overdoes things, being too stupid to stop work unless actually ordered to, so your house gets flooded as it brings pail after pail from the well. This, however, always seems to have happened somewhere else, some good while ago, and can be disregarded. One minor snag is that just occasionally they down tools and go off for a few hours, leaving a message that today is for them a holy day. Apart from that, they are perfect machines for work. Few in Ankh-Morpork remember who first made a golem, or why, or how. Recent archaeological discoveries, described in Making Money, indicate that particularly fine specimens existed in the ancient city of back in the Clay Age some 60,000 years ago. When Rincewind visited the Counterweight continent, see Interesting Times, he accidentally roused a vast red army of 7,000 terracotta golems, which were standing guard inside the burial mound of some very ancient emperor. But again, nothing is known of their making. To learn more, one must turn to the more recent traditions of Jewish communities in Central and Eastern Europe. For there, by one of those remarkable freaks of cosmic resonance, the story of the making of the golem first appeared in 15th century Germany, and by the 17th century had become famous. In Hebrew, the word golem means an unshaped lump of matter, an imperfect or incomplete creation. According to legend, various extremely learned and pious rabbis knew how to create a humanoid being out of clay, thanks to the magical power of holy words and letters, especially the four letters forming the name of God. The act echoed that of God himself, informing Adam from the dust of the earth, and for that reason, most rabbis never put their knowledge into practice, for fear of blasphemy. But a few did, to get themselves a servant, or to get help in times of great danger. The fullest and most famous story is about Judah Lo ben Bezalel, chief rabbi of Prague towards the end of the 16th century. In 1580, the Jews of Prague were under attack from anti-Semitic fanatics, and Rabbi Lo received a divine message telling him to create a golem for their protection. Four elements would be required: earth, fire, water, and air. He went with two disciples to the bank of the river Volta and molded a human form of clay. Then one disciple danced round it seven times from right to left, saying certain words which invoked the element of fire, causing it to glow like red-hot metal. The other disciple danced round it seven times from left to right, saying words to invoke the element of water. And by the time he had finished, steam was rising, and the golem's hair and nails had begun to grow. Finally, Rabbi Lo himself danced round seven times, breathed air into the golem's nostrils, and put a parchment with a word on it into its mouth, or some say, wrote a word upon its brow. Then the golem came to life and stood up, though it lacked the power of speech. Rabbi Lo said, "Your mission is to walk the streets of Prague and keep my people safe from persecution. You will obey my commands and go wherever I send you, into fire, into water, or down to the floor of the sea." What was the word that gave a golem life? Some say it was Shem, which means name and refers to the tetragrammaton, J-H-V-H, the never-to-be-spoken holy name of God. Others say it was Emeth, truth, and that one could destroy the golem by rubbing out the first letter, leaving meth, which means death. For eventually, all legends agree, something will go wrong, and the golem will have to be killed. Perhaps it has grown so big and powerful that its maker can no longer control it, or perhaps he has forgotten to give it its orders for the day, and it has gone berserk through having nothing to do, and is about to devastate the city. In Prague, Rabbi Lo kept his golem till 1593. But then, knowing the danger of persecution had passed, he and his disciples reversed their rituals, reducing it to a mere mass of clay. This they sealed up in the attic of the synagogue, and Rabbi Lo ordered that nobody was ever to set foot in that attic again. And nobody ever has. Such was the sad destiny of Earth's golems. In the Discworld, thanks to the ferocious sense of justice of Commander Vimes and the pragmatism of Lord Vetinari, golems are now in process of buying their freedom from their masters and have acquired speech and independence of thought. The words in their heads are those they have chosen themselves. Still untiring and sternly moral, some have found a role as law enforcers. One instance of this is described in Going Postal. Naturally, this requires a certain modification of one of the basic laws of golems, which now runs, "You shall not harm a human being or allow a human being to come to harm unless ordered to do so by a properly constituted authority." As we have said, Lord Vetinari is a pragmatic ruler. That is not the same as nice. Werewolves. Wherever wolves are found in the multiverse, there are werewolves too. Yet the condition of werewolfery, or lycanthropy, as those of more scientific bent prefer to call it, remains mysterious. What can be the cause? Is it voluntary or involuntary? Is it a magical power or a form of madness? Are werewolves heroes, victims, or criminals? The clash of theories is obvious on Earth. Several ancient Greek writers blamed religious cannibalism, allegedly practiced in honor of Lycaon, i.e. wolfish Zeus, in the wild hilly regions of Arcadia. According to Pausanias, a Greek geographer writing in AD 166, the first werewolf was a certain King Lycaon of Arcadia, whose very name means wolf. Lycaon brought a human baby to the altar of Lycaon Zeus, and sacrificed it, and poured out the blood upon the altar, and they say that immediately after the sacrifice, he was turned into a wolf. For my own part, I believe the tale. It had been handed down among the Arcadians from antiquity, and probability is in its favor. They say that from the time of Lycaon downwards, one man has always been turned into a wolf at the festival of Lycaon Zeus, but that the transformation is not for life, for if, while he is a wolf, he abstains from human flesh, in the ninth year afterwards he changes back into a man. But if he has tasted human flesh, he remains a beast forever. About 100 years earlier, the Roman author Petronius had included a werewolf story, more or less as a joke, in his comic novel Satyricon. To him, it was simply magical shape-shifting. A young soldier deliberately turned into a wolf by taking off his clothes in a graveyard by moonlight and pissing round them, and went off to kill cattle and sheep. But then, like many shapeshifters before and since, he was wounded while in animal form, and so his secret was discovered. In later European folklore, all sorts of explanations were suggested. Some said it was a magic art of warriors who went into battle as wolves by wearing a wolf's pelt. Others, that it was due to a spell which a witch could lay on a man by striking him with a wolfskin glove. Others, that it came from accidentally eating a particular magic plant, or bathing in a particular lake. Others, that it was a curse that a child was born with, as a punishment because his parents conceived him on a holy day when sex was not allowed, or because his mother used magic to avoid a painful childbirth. See the section earlier on vampires, where this same thing is mentioned as one possible cause for the condition. For much of the early history of these creatures, that is, before the days when vampires dressed snappily and werewolves generally managed to keep their trousers on, they were, in most cultures, pretty much the same thing. Someone who was a werewolf when alive would keep up the bad work by becoming a vampire when dead. Others, that the man had made a deliberate pact with the devil and went about murdering people while in his wolf form. In more recent centuries, it has been generally assumed that lycanthropy was a madman's delusion. Attitudes vary according to the theories. Wolf warriors were admired as heroes. The victims of spells and curses were to be pitied as well as feared. The lunatics were to be locked up, but murderous Satanist werewolves were to be tried and hanged. There are no such crazy notions on the Discworld. There, everybody knows that being a werewolf is just something that you're born with, something that runs in families. It's not supernatural, but it's very, very embarrassing, especially if you live in a town. Most humans and dwarfs find werewolves both frightening and disgusting, so werewolves do all they can to keep their condition secret, and most of the time they can pass as human. But if, when in wolf shape, they were to meet real wolves, they could never pass as wolf. The scent is quite different. And for the most part, real wolves detest werewolves. So, one way and another, werewolves lead a lonely life. The genetic laws governing Discworld werewolfery are logical, but far more complex than the transformation rules of Earth, since the condition can show itself in different forms. Ludmilla Cake, who is a classic bimorph werewolf, is a tall, strong girl for 3 weeks in every month, though a careful observer might note that her hair is unusually thick and long. In the week of the full moon, however, she becomes a wolf and stays in her room, so as not to upset the neighbours. Sometimes preliminary signs appear a day or two before what her mother coyly refers to as your time. Something came in from the backyard. It was clearly, even attractively, female in general shape, and wore a perfectly ordinary dress. It was also, apparently, suffering from a case of superfluous hair, that not all the delicate pink roses in the world could erase. Also, teeth and fingernails were being worn long this season. You expected the whole thing to growl, but it spoke in a pleasant and definitely human voice. From Reaper Man. Mrs. Cake's forebears had originally come from the Ramtop Mountains, and she suspected that Ludmilla was a throwback to this distant past. She was pretty sure that her own mother had once alluded, circumspectly, to a great-uncle Erasmus, who sometimes had to eat his meals under the table. The exact opposite of a werewolf is a wolfman. For 3 weeks in every month, he is simply a wolf. But as soon as he sees the full moon, he stops howling, most of his hair temporarily falls out, and next minute he's standing up, walking and talking. The problem is, no clothes. So when the full moon is due to rise, a canny wolfman takes care to get back to where he keeps a pair of trousers stashed. It is to be hoped that Lupin, the wolfman, and Ludmilla, the werewolf, have managed to find happiness together, despite having to pay more attention to the calendar than most couples. Sergeant Angua, of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch, is different again. Like Ludmilla, she is compelled to become a wolf during the time of the full moon, but in addition, she has the power to shapeshift at will, by day or night, at any time of the month. This gift is a great advantage to her in police work. When in wolf form, she has a superb sense of smell, thanks to which she can track anyone, anywhere, and decipher subtle clues at crime scenes. And, as many a villain has found out, it is most disconcerting to chase an attractive and unprotected girl into a dark alley, only to find a pile of discarded clothes and a large she-wolf, teeth bared. However, she has certain weaknesses. For a day or two before her change, she becomes irritable, due to pre-lunar tension. When she is in wolf form, the touch of any silver object gives her intense pain, and, like werewolves on the earth, she is vulnerable to silver bullets. Some strong smells overwhelm her delicate nose, bringing on the equivalent of acute hay fever. Angua's parents are the extremely aristocratic Baron Guy von Überwald, also known as Silvertail, and Baroness Seraphine von Überwald, also known as Yellowfang. The Baron spends most of his time in wolf form, to the annoyance of his wife. Angua had a brother named Wolfgang, a magnificently built and very athletic young man with strongly Nietzschean views, who made a terrifying wolf and would have felt quite at home in the SS. Even his father was afraid of him, but as she tells Carrot, she also has another brother, André, and she did have a sister named Elsa, till Wolfgang killed her. He said it was an accident. Poor little Elsa. She was a Yanork, just like André. That's a werewolf that doesn't change, you know. I'm sure I've mentioned it. Our family throws them up from time to time. Wolfgang and I were the only classic bimorphs in the litter. Elsa looked human all the time, even at full moon. André was always a wolf.
You mean you had a human sister and a wolf brother?
No, Carrot. They were both werewolves, but the, well, the little switch inside them didn't work. They stayed the same shape. In the old days, the clan would kill off a Yanork quickly, and Wolfgang is a traditionalist when it comes to nastiness. He says they made the blood impure. You see, a Yanork would go off and be a human or a wolf, but they'd still be carrying the werewolf blood, and then they'd marry and have children or pups, and, well, that's where the fairy tale monsters come from. People with a bit of wolf, and wolves with that extra capacity for violence that is so very human. But Elsa was harmless. After that, André didn't wait for it to happen to him. He's a sheepdog over in Borogravia now, doing well, I hear. Wins championships. From the Fifth Elephant. Not surprisingly, Angua has broken with her family. But the existence of the Yanork explains a lot. No doubt the aristocratic werewolves guarded their pedigrees carefully, but mistakes will happen, even in the best regulated families. Igors. The Igors are a very numerous humanoid family in the Oberwald region, each of whom is named either Igor or Igorina. They are not, of course, undead, but are usually standing very close to a corpse. They are, in fact, a big nod to the cinematic cliché that whenever there is a brain to be collected or a big crackling switch to be pulled, then there is an Igor, or someone who looks very much like him, ready and willing to do the job. Igors are heavily built, with a strong tendency to lurch and shamble, and they speak with a heavy, spluttering lisp. For generations, many of them have gone into service in the households of aristocratic vampires in Oberwald, where it is their pride and joy to ensure that massive doors creak, candles gutter, cobwebs abound, and carriages look as much like hearses as possible. They have a keen appreciation of all the traditional trappings of horror. Sadly, earthly vampires, unlike those of the disc, seem never to have employed Igors. As we have pointed out, they did not have many visitors. Another reason why Igors like working for vampires is that their castles usually have large, deep, cool cellars where an Igor can quietly pursue his real interests. The whole clan has a remarkable hereditary skill in surgery, especially transplants and wound repair, including the replacing of severed limbs. This they practice both on themselves and on others. You can always recognize an Igor by his distinctly patchwork look and interestingly individual scar patterns, and maybe an extra thumb or mismatched eyes. In many cases, you could place a ball on the top of his head, and it would not roll off. The Igorinas, on the other hand, use their skill to look absolutely stunning, but always include some fetching little detail, a beautifully curved scar under one eye, a line of decorative stitching round the wrist, to maintain the family look. Since Igors hate discarding any body part that could be recycled, an elderly member of the clan will make arrangements for the best bits of himself to be shared out among his kin when the time comes. They have a great fondness for heirlooms. Among Igors, he's got his grandfather's hands, is likely to be literally true. There is a tradition among Igors that the ancestor who first learned surgery was working for a mad doctor at the time. A more recent member of the clan, who diversified into extremely delicate clockmaking, produced references from a series of employers whose hold on sanity appears to have been shaky. Mad Doctor Scoop. Crazed Baron Ha-Ha, crushed by a burning windmill. Screaming Dr. Berserk, died of blood poisoning caused by a dirty pitchfork. And demented Dr. Wimble, who discovered how to make the perfect clock while working on a scheme to extract sunshine from oranges. This particular Igor has a passion for electricity and thunderstorms, as described in Thief of Time. There are few echoes of the Igors on Earth, and those that there are only to be found in modern cinema and comic strips, not in age-old folklore. However, they do support the idea that an Igor once worked for a Dr. Frankenstein, who was definitely crazy, on a job which involved a great deal of stitching body parts together and exposing them to lightning. The doctor wouldn't have got far without his help. Despite the people they work for, Igors are generally well-intentioned, nay, spiritual beings. Most religions teach that the body is just an outer garment, to be shed in due time, and Igors think, in a provident way, that items with some wear left in them should not be wasted. Zombies. It is not strictly accurate to include the Discworld zombies in this chapter, since, unlike werewolves, golems, or Igors, they do not constitute a separate race or species. On the contrary, a zombie is simply a human being who obstinately remains sort of alive when he has, in fact, died. He ought to lie mouldering in his grave, instead of wandering around looking vaguely grey, with fingers dropping off occasionally. No one knows why some people are natural zombies. It may simply be stubborn bloody-mindedness, an inborn refusal to kowtow to any authority, even that of death. What death thinks of this situation has not been recorded. On the disc, it would seem that zombies keep the personalities they had when alive, more or less intact, with the result that the four we know best are strikingly different. One is Mr. Slant, the eminent lawyer who can count most of the upper-class families in Ankh-Morpork among his clients. He is dry as dust, in a very literal sense, and though he would never, of course, do anything illegal, it is not wise to cross him. He knows family secrets going back for an uncomfortable number of generations. At the opposite end of the city's social and political spectrum is Reg Shu. In life, he saw himself as a romantic revolutionary. In death, he devotes most of his energies to protesting at society's unjust prejudice and discrimination towards the undead. Then there is the old wizard, Windle Poons, who finds his time as a zombie considerably more exciting than his actual life had been, as we learn in Reaper Man. In his case, however, it is merely a temporary state, the default setting for someone who happens to die when death is not around to do whatever it is he does with his scythe. And in distant Genua, there is Baron Saturday, a zombie who may be something more than just that. His name and his appearance suggest that he has an earthly counterpart in the sinister Baron Samadhi in Haiti, a being who is not himself a zombie or ghost, but a spirit lord of the dead. He is seen at crossroads and in cemeteries, and can be recognized by his black tuxedo, white top hat, dark glasses, and skull-like face. He is greatly feared. Earth zombies, who are only to be found in the traditional beliefs of Haiti, are very, very different, despite the identical name and despite the fact that they, too, are undead humans. Their condition is due to the spells of some voodoo sorcerer who has called them from their graves, and who, some say, was responsible for putting them down there in the first place, having sent them into a death-like trance by a secret poison concocted from the liver of a very rare fish. It appears, from a conversation recorded in Reaper Man, that the Wizards of Unseen University have heard rumors about this. When Haitian zombies emerge, their minds and souls have gone. They have become mere robots, incapable of speech, who must serve the sorcerer as his slaves. However, there is one way to rescue a zombie. Give him salted food or salt water to drink, and his soul and his power of speech will be restored. It is said there was once a girl who died and was buried, but she was seen 3 years later working very long hours in a boutique. She looked much the same as in the past, except that her neck was twisted, and that was because her coffin had been too small, and they had had to force her head down. But she spoke to nobody, and her eyes had no life in them. Reg Shu, the tireless revolutionary and champion of the rights of the undead, would be unspeakably angry if he knew the plight of the poor, exploited, downtrodden zombies of Haiti.